From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made about two decades ago when a mother was reunited with her children. As a child, Anna Quinetta Campbell was in the foster care system for about 10 years. When she was about 14, she was placed back with her mother. She didn't know at that time that just a few years later, the cycle would repeat itself with her. As a young mother, Anna Quinetta struggled with an addiction to drugs. She says at the time, the foster system was a safe haven for her. In a podcast during which she shared her story, she says it was a relief when a judge told her that her kids would be placed with a foster family. She acknowledged that with them in a safe place, she could work on getting the help she needed so she could be healthy and create a stable home for her children. After about 5 years, Anna Quinetta was reunited with her kids, who had been placed with the Sisters of Mercy. Now she's been clean for about 20 years. Hers is a success story, with a family being reunited. It's not always the case. Regardless of the outcomes, advocates for children in the foster care system say there are challenges and barriers that make it difficult to meet the complex needs of foster kids. According to data from youth.gov, when young people age out of the system with limited connections or support, they are at increased risk for unstable housing or homelessness, for a lack of adequate education, for unemployment or a lack of job training, for health issues and a lack of access to health care, and for involvement in the justice system. So what can be done to eliminate those challenges and create better outcomes for young people who have been a part of the foster system? Our guests this hour share their expertise, their experiences, and their personal views on navigating a system that everyone agrees there are wonderful success stories and there are probably solutions to make the system better. And I'd like to welcome in studio now, Ashley Cross is the founder, executive director, and hope giver for the Hub 585. Ashley, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Evan.
And tell us about the Hub 585, by the way.
Yeah, so the Hub 585, we started in 2018 with a mission to educate, enrich, and empower youth and families through programs and partnerships that give them hope and help them thrive. We started off with a small platform. It's a national initiative called the Care Portal in partnership with the Department of Human Services. In October of 2019, we launched that, and it really helps to put children that are in crisis situations in connection with people in the community that can help stabilize their environment. Our hope is that through that, we're able to prevent children from going into the foster care system, if at all possible, or support them if, for whatever reason, they have to go into the foster care system. So we've been running that platform since October of 2019, served 937 children to this day. And now we're starting to really expand our work in the community to work with Rochester's most vulnerable children and families.
You're also Jordan Edwards' mom.
I am Jordan Edwards' mom.
That's an important title.
It is.
Jordan Edwards is a foster alumnus and Ashley's daughter. Jordan, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us on the line, let me welcome Marla Dinkle, who is a foster alumnus. Hi, Marla. Thank you for being with us.
Hi. And I'm grateful to be here. Thank you for having me.
We are grateful to have you, Marla. Thank you. And Anne Quinetta Campbell, foster alumnus and mother of Annette Campbell. Hi, Anne Quinetta. Thank you for being with us.
Hello, you guys. Thanks for having me.
And Annette Campbell, foster alumnus and Quinetta's daughter. And nice to have you back with us, Annette. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So a lot to talk about here. And let me start with Ashley Cross and talk a little bit more about so I think right now the national focus is on the foster care system for two reasons. One is one of the obvious, that it's National Foster Care Awareness Month. There's a lot of efforts being made to put foster care in the spotlight, to talk about improving that system, et cetera.
Yeah.
And then, as I said at the outset, right at 1 o'clock, this is not a show about Roe v. Wade. This is not a show about abortion. Yep. But ever since the leaked documents from the Supreme Court came out and the likely overturning of Roe came up, there's been a lot of review of, for example, Justice Amy Coney Barrett has said a lot about the importance of the foster care system. And, you know, if we see a reduction in abortion services, likely we'll have more kids heading in that direction. And I think there's a lot of emphasis now that there isn't always on foster care. How do you view the health of the system right now?
It is a overtaxed system. It's an overtaxed system like many of our systems here, right? It's a high demand, lots of children, lots of needs, complex needs, and not always the resources to support them. I always say that I think CPS workers are some of the greatest heroes, right? I think that they are working night and day to try to alleviate some serious crisis situations. However, I always say that the system was not designed and does not successfully raise children. And I think that CPS workers will agree with that. That is not their intent to raise children. So it's an overtaxed system that does not have the resources to give these children what they need for. And it's not just safety and protection. It's well-being. It's children deserve to be in situations that increase their well-being.
Yeah, we're going to be hearing personal stories. We're going to talk to Marla and Quinetta and Annette. I mean, their stories, I think, are important and instructive to us. And can you tell me a little bit before we talk to Jordan about your first encounter with Jordan?
Yeah, I first encountered Jordan probably it was a few weeks before she turned 18 years old. She was living at a youth shelter in Oklahoma. I was running a girls' home, a home for girls aging out of the foster care system. So that was my other full-time job. But then my other full-time job was working at a shelter for kids that were in the foster care system. And Jordan came in a few weeks before turning 18. And the director of the shelter actually was like, hey, you should meet this young lady. She might be a good fit for your home. And so I you know, went and visit with Jordan, met with her, talked to her a little bit about her journey and what kind of her goals were and what she was actually kind of thinking about doing, because she could have signed herself back into foster care, which she ended up doing, or she could have, you know, left to kind of seek independence on her own, which we know a lot of young people try and it doesn't always work out the way that they want it. So met Jordan. She's amazing. Started off as one of the girls in my foster home, and quickly became someone that I was like, I think she's family, like long-term family. And so when I moved here in 2016, I got married. One of the first questions I asked my husband was how he felt about fostering. And I actually asked him that before we got married, because that was a make or breaker for me. Like, you got to be all in. And luckily I married someone who is also just amazing man, but his family did foster care. So this is nothing new to him. So when I moved here, I asked him how he felt about Jordan joining our family. And he was like, let's do it. So 6 months after getting married, I still remember it like it was yesterday. I called Jordan. I was like, hey, I have a question to ask you. The only rule is that you cannot answer it right now. You have to think about it for a week. And that's because I didn't want her to just try to appease me, say something that she thought is what we wanted to hear, but I really wanted her to think about her decision. And so I asked her, and I think immediately she was like, yes. I was like, no, there's a rule. You got to think about it.
How did you put it to her?
I asked her, I said, well, Jordan, you know, I moved down here and I understand that you're doing pretty well. Like, Jordan did, and I tell people all the time, Jordan did not need us. She didn't need us to save her. She did not need us. But the thing was, we were like, Jordan still needs family. Like, at some point, like, these kids, they still need someone that's going to walk them down the aisle when they get married. She's still going to have a child one day and call me probably 50 times about, what do you do when you're a first-time mom? Like, all those reasons I still need my mom as an adult, those don't just go away. So I remember just asking her, hey, Jordan, how would you feel about moving to New York and, you know, being a part of me and Melvin's family? Is that how it went?
Yeah, it just pretty much that's how it went.
And Jordan, do me a favor. I put that mic too high. Bring it even a little bit more down. Take the top of it, bring it down. And I want to hear from you. Yeah, there you go. See this part right here? Look at this. That's okay. We're all learning as we go here. There you go. So Jordan, when you got that call, you were told you got to wait a week. You can't answer
right
now.
So
you didn't want to wait?
I knew automatically that I wanted to. I didn't really have anything to really think about, because I knew I was already a part of my mom's family. So I didn't really have nothing to think about. It was automatically yes, for sure.
Were you hoping to get that call at some point? Had you thought about that in your heart?
Yes. So it was, I mean, I knew she had left and moved to New York. And so at that point, I was like, what's going to happen? We're here. But she had staff at the girls' home, and that was awesome. But then she was far away now. So when she called, it was very exciting and like, okay, yay, I get to move with her now and be a part of family. And also just being with her is just, I love it.
For you, Ashley, I know you wanted her to take a week, but what did it mean to you that she didn't need a week?
So I'll be honest. I was really nervous about asking her. I think my husband and I, we talked about it probably maybe 2 months before I actually asked her.
Did you think she could say no?
I did.
You did?
I did. And the reason was because, you know, Jordan went into foster care when she was young. And so that's, for me, that's one heartbreak, right? Like, you go into foster care. She was adopted after going into foster care, her adoptive mother, due to abuse to her and her siblings, she was put back into the foster care system. So in my mind, I'm running this. I'm like, I'm basically asking this girl to give a shot, like give her third shot to a mom, right? Like, you have your bio mom,
yeah.
You had an adoptive mom, the adoption failed, and now I'm asking you if you want to be a part of my family, right? So I was a little nervous that she might be like, no, I'm good. Like, I've tried this family thing twice, and it keeps failing, you know? So I was more nervous about being rejected, to be very honest. And I did. I thought that she could very well be like, I'd rather stay in Tulsa, and where at least it's a little bit
hard
easier.
To blame her if she ended up in that
Absolutely.
Spot. Right?
Absolutely. Like, I would not have. We still would. I would still think she was family and probably call her all the time and still FaceTime her and everything if she said no, because I would have understood. Like, I definitely would have understood.
So we're going to, in a moment, we're going to hear Marla and Ann Quinetta and Annette share their experiences. But let me just ask you sort of the bigger picture of the foster care question. When it's going, when it works, mm-hmm. what are the outcomes? What does it look like? When it doesn't work, what do you see?
Yeah, when it works, children have some sense of permanency, right? It doesn't even have to be adoption, but they know whether it was the foster parent, whether it was a mentorship program, some adult came in and intercepted for them, right? Came in and said, okay, I know that you guys have had so much disappointment, trauma, betrayal, but I'm going to come in and I'm going to be that stabilizing factor. That's when it works. Whether it's the foster parent, a coach, some adult comes in and helps to bring some sense of stability in their life. Foster kids, they move so much. There were times that I would have a girl in my home, 16, 17 years old, and I would look in her chart and she's had 18 homes. Like, that's what it looks like to fail. We have a 16-year-old that has been uprooted from her school, from her home, from norms, everything 18 times. And then you expect for them to become productive citizens when they turn 18. So for to you know, success is to stabilize them as much as we can, to give them permanency, to give them some sense of hope. For it to fail, it looks like us to continue to drop the ball. Children in foster care are broken, and it's only because of adults. Like, they've done nothing on their own to be there. And so for it to be a success, somebody has to come in and stabilize them. For it to be a failure, it's for us to continue to ignore the fact that these are kids that have deep traumas. Their behaviors are going to sometimes speak to those traumas. If we keep moving them, every single time their behavior tells us that they're hurt, because that's what their behavior is telling us, is that they're hurt, that they're traumatized. If we keep moving them, then the data shows it. There is a foster care to prison pipeline. The data shows that if they age out of foster care without permanency, they're headed to prison, they're headed to homelessness, or sometimes even death, right? So there has to be someone that comes in and intercepts.
When it comes to the adults who are in the system, the adults who are in the system for the right reasons are doing it why, and the adults who probably should not be in the system mm-hmm. are doing it why.
Yeah, the ones who are doing it for the right reasons really have a heart to create some sense of permanency. But I really think, to take it a step further, the ones that are really in it for the right reasons, they have to be the most selfless people, because you have to... I tell people all the time, you're going in to try to get that kid back home. That's what success looks like, is if you can help bridge. Like, that's why I love Aunt Quinetta's story, because what the Sisters of Mercy did for her was created additional support and a safety net. So that's what you're going in for the right reason. You understand that even if that means that that child does not stay with me forever, I want them to have a sense of permanency. I want their parents to succeed. Right. We know that doesn't always work, but that should be our number one goal. People that go in for the wrong reasons are sometimes one to meet some type of unmet need in their own lives. Right. So you see that sometimes happening, where there are adults that go into fostering that really they're just not ready, right? They want to be loved. They want to be accepted. It's like, if you're expecting a child in foster care to provide that for you, you're going to be disappointed. You're going to be disappointed. I hear people always say, kids in foster care should be grateful. And I'm like, grateful for what?
Yeah.
Like, why would you say that, right? But that's going in with the wrong motive. And people bring up always like the financial side of it. And nobody's getting rich off of becoming a foster parent, right? So I like to dispel that myth that people are signing up just for the funds. I mean, there is some added bonus to, you know, I guess taking in a kid. There are some financial, you know, supports that come in, but most people are not going in for that.
There's easier ways to make money.
Yeah.
No, I actually really appreciate you making this point about people. I bet you the assumption that a lot of listeners had was that she's going to say money. The parents who are in it for the wrong reasons, money. As opposed to, don't go in there because you need your cup to be filled up. Mm-hmm. Go in to fill somebody else's cup.
Yep.
It's a huge difference.
Yeah, because you start to take everything they do personal. Like, we're starting a mentorship program. I'm like, guys, don't take anything these kids do or say personal. Yeah. It's not about you. They slam the door in your face. They get upset. They don't answer your phone calls. It's not probably because you did anything. Like, these are hurt kids. They have really every hurt. Reason to be hurt.
Yeah, I remember, and I'm not going to mention the specific story, but I just remember a story of a pretty high-profile local story. There was video of an arrest with police on the news, mm-hmm. and it was very confrontational. And sort of the flippant way that people were like, oh, well, you know, she was in the foster system. And the way that some people talked about the kids were being arrested, the young mm-hmm. women being arrested, as if like, well, look at them. They're just bad people.
Yep.
Can you imagine
yep.
more than a dozen times back and forth thinking that no one really cares about you? There is no mm-hmm. permanence. You will never have a family that you can really speak of your own.
Yeah.
That has got to be.
It's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah.
Right. You keep saying that to someone, then they're gonna live up to the expectations that you have for them. Right. And we have really low expectations for these young people. They have very low trust for adults. I sat with a young girl the other day. We were doing her application to be a part of our mentoring program, and I said, "What's one thing that your mentor should know about you?" She said, "I don't trust adults. Like, every adult in my life has failed me." She said, "And the second thing they should know about me is I don't know who I am." And I'm like, gosh, like, those are two, like, real truths. Like, she doesn't know who she is. She's in an identity crisis because the people who are supposed to protect and provide for her are, God, you know, doing whatever, sending her in this crisis of an identity crisis. But number two is, like, I don't trust adults. And I'm like, well, that makes – I wouldn't either. Every adult in her life has failed her.
How can the system vet the adults who do get into the system better?
So the issue with that is the system is desperate. So I think that they overlook some signs. They just want to know that, like, you're not going to abuse kids, you're not going to hurt them. And to me, that's like the bare minimum.
That's a low bar.
It's a very low bar.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're talking like minimal standard of care. Like, does a kid have a bed? Are you going to, are they going to be safe? But they're not looking at, like, maybe the psychological wellness of someone, you know, their motives. I'm doing some studies on hope and foster parents. Like, what is it? Like, we want high hope individuals. We really want high hope individuals that are trauma informed if we want good foster parents and foster parents that are going to last long term.
On any given day in the U.S., according to childrensrights.org, there are nearly 424,000 kids in foster care in this country. So we're talking about a lot of children, and this is really important stuff. You're hearing Ashley Cross and Jordan Edwards. And I want to turn to our guests on the phone for their stories. And I mentioned Ann Quinetta Campbell's story right off the top here. But Ann Quinetta, can I give you a little bit of space to kind of elaborate and maybe tell your own story and your experience with the system first?
Sure. First and foremost, I'm sitting here like going back. And it's taking me back and looking at where I was, where I've been, and where I am now in my own personal life and with my children. I was a foster care child, and my kids went to foster care. So I'm on both sides of that. And being a foster care kid, I'm just grateful to God that, like, he was in the midst of everything, because the foster parents that I had when I was taken from my mom, they were very loving and caring people, and they wanted to help. And it wasn't just physically giving you somewhere to stay, making sure you were safe, but they talked with us, and, you know, they supported us, and they not only verbally said it, but they kind of showed us that they were there of support for us. And I had a pastor and a first lady. They owned their own church, this, that, and you know, it was wonderful. I was grateful to be placed where I was. Now, coming out of that, coming back home to my mom was not a real good thing. And as a result, I turned to the drugs, definitely not trusting people. Like, that's a major, like, number one thing foster kids have instilled, the trauma, things that have happened, not even really feeling like you have a voice to even be safe enough to share where you've been, where you are, and can you really help me? Like, it's just so much with that. So coming home back to my mom, really not being sure about any of that stuff. As a result, you know, basically going to the streets, using drugs, being with the wrong people, feeling, and it's weird because I felt comfortable with the people that were not safe for me versus the people that were safe for me. I wasn't comfortable with them. Like, that warped sense of, man, it was just a lot. Long story short, having children, you know, being caught up in the drug life and medicating, not wanting to fail, not wanting to deal, not knowing how to deal with past trauma, past, you know, failures. So medicating was like the easier thing to do. As a result of that, getting into some trouble, and God, I felt like, and this is my story, I felt like God intervened. I always felt like there was some spiritual being that was walking with me. I didn't really know at the time that it was a God and that he was placing people in my life, in my walk, in my path. But being rebellion and not knowing and not understanding and not having an identity, not knowing who I was, you know, living on the edge, it came to a point where it was like, okay, God was basically saying to me, like, I either help you or you're going to kill yourself. Because at one point I thought about it. I thought about suicide. You know, I thought about, like, nobody loves me. Nobody cares about me. My mom don't want me. She's caught up in her stuff and this, that, and the third. Like, it was a lot. I went through a lot. Me, my brother, and my sister. Long story short, having children and each child that I had being drug addicted, being taken from me right after having my children, like, that was traumatizing. Of course, I wanted to medicate, you know, because I didn't want to feel that, like, that void, like, that soul void that I felt. And as a result of that, having the kids and voluntarily saying, hey, look, I can't do this. I'm not a mom. I'm not ready for this. Take them. Like, the shame and guilt from that, just dealing with that, like I could write a book. But long story short, like, making a decision at some point in my life, like, wow, you know what? All of my kids, and I don't really remember, like, when that, like, the little light at the end of the tunnel, and it was like, wait a minute, I have these children that are placed. I feel empty. I don't feel worthy. But I know I need to do something. Life cannot just be this. And I wanted to get help. Like, I had a lady that would come and check on me, social worker. Like, there are some social workers that care and foster, you know, social workers that place you in foster care is some of them that care, and it's some of them it's a paycheck for them as well. Like, it's two sides to that coin. And I had one lady that just wouldn't give up on me. I don't know what it was she seen or what. And she was like, I'm not going to give up on you. I'm not. I understand. I've closed doors in her faces, all kind of stuff. Long story short, she helped me. She was like, listen, you need to get some help. I'm like, do you want the help? And that's when I went into treatment for rehab. And that's where my journey began with me wanting my children and wanting to be a parent. Like, once I was able to feel secure, trust people a little bit, have the stability, then and take care of myself and kind of clean myself up a little bit to where I could feel and hear and internalize, then it came like, okay, your kids are here. You can visit with them. You can see them. They're here with the nuns. I mean, they're angels from God, I swear. and just not only them loving and caring for my children sincerely, but loving and caring for me individually and wanting me to be with my kids, wanting to reunite me and my kids together, to be together. Like, that was something that it used to blow my mind when I would go there and visit the kids, and they would have my favorite food, and the kids would be, we would have lunch or dinner or whatever. Like, they were very much so in support of me reuniting and connecting with my kids. But also, once the kids came home, they never left. They would come and visit, call, check on me to make sure, because it wasn't what helped me. They not only supported my children, they supported me and my children. They gave me what I needed for the little support, and then they supported the kids, and then they supported us as a family. And they became our extended family.
And Quinetta, let me just jump in for 1 second, only because I think Annette's got to board a flight in a second, and I want to make sure she gets a chance. Is that right, Annette? I want to make sure you get a little chance to tell. I hate interrupting this story.
No, I'm so sorry. Yes, I was like, let me try to.
Do not miss your flight, Annette. Do not miss it. But can you also just briefly, Annette, can you weigh in on the power of the support from the Sisters of Mercy that your mother was talking about?
Yes. When I was in foster care, I call them my angels. They're truly my angels. They were just the most selfless, just nurturing people that I was actually able to be placed with when my mom couldn't, you know, take care of us. So I was super grateful for their support, their love, and just everything that they instilled in us to help us just make sure that we're successful. So it was I'm grateful. Because I hear the stories of, you know, foster kids who are not in the greatest, they get placed in bad homes. So I was super grateful.
And I'm going to try to squeeze in one more quick question for you, Annette, and then I promise we'll let you go.
Okay.
I hope you're proud of your mother, but tell me what you think about when you think about what everything she's been through and you think about the obvious love she has for her kids, but the journey she needed to go on to get to that point where she could be more present.
Yes, I'm super grateful. I feel like I get my own resilience of me just overcoming a lot of things in my life to beat the odds and not be considered a statistic of foster kids. I'm super proud of her. I love her. And if she did not take the necessary decisions and choices to help get her life together, to get us back, I think, you know, our life could look a lot differently. So I'm grateful.
I hear them boarding it. You better go, Annette.
Yes.
Annette Campbell, we're going to let you go.
See you when you get back, daughter.
All righty. Thank you.
What a great, what an amazing moment here. And Quinetta, how proud are you of Annette?
Oh, goodness. Like, she is amazing. I don't know. Words cannot express how I feel about my daughter. I'm very proud of her. I'm proud of her in a lot of ways, in a lot of areas of her life that she has overcome. And I'm getting teary-eyed because all of this, it just brings up a lot of emotions and feelings, good, bad, and indifferent, because it's a place for all of it. You know what I mean? Her having her own business now and just being wanting to be the backbone for young adults with trying to set their lives, not waiting until they get 30 and 40 years old, but like high school, you can get yourself situated and build the foundation, because if your foundation is not stable, the house won't, it ain't going to stay. It'll fall, you know? So her gung-ho, her resilience, her willpower to want to help others, like that desire and that passion that she has, I know she get it from her mama, but you know, just the fact that she her love for people, you know what I mean? Like it appalls me. And not only with her, like my son, that's a captain in the Marine Corps, my son Jamal, his love for helping people and being there. My younger son, her baby brother Cedric, which is 20, like his love for, like, he'll give you whatever, you know, he'll stop and talk with you and share whatever he can. You know what I'm saying? And my older son as well. I love her. I love her. I love her. I do. You know what I mean?
Well,
I love her.
Let me also tell listeners just a little bit more, because listeners might remember a little bit of Annette Campbell, who's been on the program before. She's the founder of The Tax Experience. She's been on the show previously. She's brilliant. And yeah, she went through the foster care system. And part of what we want to do this hour is to be real. The success stories, the beauty, the important interventions are what the system needs to be for all the kids who end up in it. And a lot of people think about, well, foster care is, you know, newborns and kids very young. The average age of a kid who enters the system is 8. There are kids of all different ages and a lot of kids whose needs are not fully met. So yes, the reality is the beauty, the story of Ann Quinetta, the story of Annette Campbell. In a moment, you'll hear Marla Dinkle's story. But it's also the story of being real about a system that is stressed, as Ashley Cross has said. So after we take our only break, we'll come back. We'll get Marla Dinkle's story. And before the hour's up, we'll make sure that we touch on what has to happen to bring this system to where it needs to be. And I know Ashley's got more to share there. So much to do here, and we're right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, Wednesday on The Next Connections. We're joined by freelance journalist and academic Patrick Blanchfield. Blanchfield studies gun violence. We talk with him about the mass shooting in Buffalo, the history of armed young men becoming radicalized, and what can be done to prevent future tragedies of this kind. Talk with you on Wednesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We're talking about the state of the foster care system in this country. It serves hundreds of thousands of children, more than 400,000 children at any one time. And, you know, you just heard Ann Quinetta Campbell and Annette Campbell talking about their experiences and frankly, the important life-saving work of the Sisters of Mercy, Sister Kath, Sister Pat, Sister Rita, and the work that they did to build trust back and to let families know that you can come back together, you can heal. And you met Jordan Edwards earlier this hour. Before I talk to Marla, let me just ask Jordan in studio one question about trust. You know, your mom, Ashley, talked about the fact that it is understandable why so many kids in the system don't trust adults anymore, don't trust that they can have a family. Why did you trust enough to say yes? What was it that allowed you to trust?
Well, Kevin, it was the relationship that I had with her. I had the opportunity to get to know her. Going in and out of the foster care system, it wasn't too many people I got to know up close. With my mom, I got to know her personally on many different levels with our relationship. So I had time to, throughout the years that I knew her, to get to know who she was, how she did things in different aspects, like when I was adopted before, I didn't really get to know my adopted mom. I was just pretty much just there. As we got abused throughout the years, we were just honestly just there. My memory with her is very bland because of that. It's because I didn't really know who she was. I just remember what happened to us. So just getting to know her blessed me in a lot of ways.
And you knew you were loved?
Yes.
It's an amazing thing to finally really feel like, you know, when you haven't been loved, it's an amazing thing.
And can I say something?
Yeah, Anconetti, yeah.
With her saying that, thank you for sharing that, because it brought me to, like, when the kids were with the sisters, I had to build a relationship with them. And my fear as a mom was like, you know, as they got older, like, they're not going to like me. They're not going to want to be with me. Like, I had to do in-home counseling with all of the kids because it was like they were torn. Like, they knew they were they had two and three mommies over there, and then they have a mom over here. And it was hard. And I was like, man, I wonder if the kids are going to ever love me or forgive me or, you know what I mean? Like, it was so much going on. So I made a decision, and I reached out and asked for help. Like, I was grateful for the support that I had because I could ask for help not only for myself but for the kids, because I really wanted to have my family. And the kids being older, like, I was able to really sit and talk with them and say, man, and hear how they felt and what they thought and what they went through and not judge them, you know what I mean, or be ashamed of how they felt and what they thought of me, you know, as their mom. Like, why were they placed? Why were they, you know, like, it was a lot, but we got through it. And I made sure that when each one of the kids came home, that I reached out and said, listen, I think we need to do in-home counseling. Like, I'm a little overwhelmed here and this, that, and the third. And I think it would be great, you know, better for them and stuff like that. And it was just wonderful, like, the support, because I was strong enough after doing some work on myself and getting support that I needed for me to say, listen, I need help over here. And when I really wasn't ready for the kids, I remember one time they were trying to give me the kids back. And I was like, oh, no, I'm not ready for them. And I felt ashamed. And my counselor at the time was like, Ms. Campbell, that was the best thing you could have did for yourself as well as your kids. And because you're not ready for them right now, it's okay. It's not like because you're not ready, you're not going to get them again. They can stay where they at, continue to get the support. You stay doing what you're doing because you're helping yourself. That's self-help. Like, I learned so much, you know what I mean, in that time. But it was really like my kids, like, yeah, how are they going to really feel about me as a parent? You know, are they going to ever trust me? Are they ever going to, you know what I mean? And I have the most beautiful, intimate relationships with each one of my kids today. And I'm really grateful for that.
That's great. That's great. Well, let me bring in Marla Dinkle, who's a Foster alumnus, placed in foster care at the age of one. Marla, the floor is yours. Can you tell us a little bit about your story?
Yes, absolutely. Hello, everyone. I could just start out by saying, you mentioned, I heard you say and speak of being real, and I'm thankful to be invited to a discussion on this particular near and dear topic to me, but with the opportunity to really be real. Mm-hmm. So for me, I started in the system, but for me, it was foster care / institutions. And I started at one when my mother, she didn't give me away. I was taken away and I was placed into a home at the time. It was almost like an orphanage, if you will. I'm a 42-year-old woman, if that makes sense, if you can envision that. So back then, I believe it was an orphanage. And then from there, I was adopted at 2 years old. And then I lived with that family until I was placed in an institution at 10 years old. And then from that institution, I went to several different ones and was able to come out at 15 or 16, something like that. But then started living in foster homes, and I was in those until I aged out at 21. And during that time, I actually became a mother and got pregnant at 17. So during that time of transition and everything, I had my first child. And I will say, too, here in my story in the beginning, I want to tell everyone that my biological family, I learned I had siblings. They actually just found me last year, around this time last year. So I now know my biological sister and two brothers. Unfortunately, I never had the opportunity to meet my mother or father. I've learned since my father is just unknown and my mom has she's deceased. But within all of this, I want to say I am drawn to the work of the Hub 585 because for me, I think what's genuinely what I've learned and what I know to this day as a 42-year-old woman, I have five kids myself. What's, you know, mandatory is a child having love and being given this traditional kind of love. And so I'm drawn to the 585 because I look at Ashley and her work. It really extremely emphasizes that love that we need to give our young youth. And everything it means to me is to be a supporter and a person that can, you know, honestly be of access to show and share this type of love. As a 42-year-old woman, I want to just tell you guys, I still don't know how to heal from some of the things that I've endured. And a lot of times when I'm invited to discussions, it's quick. And it's not easy to kind of share all of the things. It's within pretty much my entire life that I've went through. And I even get mad at myself for using the terms that I do, foster kid or foster care system, the system, institutionalized. All of that just becomes very systemic to me, and it contributes to me and, you know, the lack of healing that I'm working on to this day.
Well, can I ask you, Marlo, when you talk about the things that are still difficult at the age of 42 to process and to kind of to heal from, what stands out the most? What has been the most damaging?
I think for me, the permanency, which you guys did discuss earlier, the permanency and stability. Because there's so many stories in between. I remember as a younger child and younger teen and younger adult, I didn't meet my first permanency, if you will, family that I believed in my heart to truly care about me until I was 17 years old. And I think that has an impact on me to this day. Again, as I said, I was adopted at two and ended up back into the, if you will, system by 10. And I struggle with, you know, wondering where was that love at? Where was that, you know, we want to get our child back and things like that. And I guess that's why, again, I'm so drawn to the Hub and the 585 Hub, because I believe what they're doing is giving out this particular traditional kind of love, if you will. And I don't, excuse me, I don't mean the love where it's like, hey, we're going to do a seminar or we're going to have a workshop or we're going to have a community event to show our support. There's a difference between support and then love. What I've noticed with this particular agency and program is love, where I've been able to come in on a couple of Saturdays and sit with the young youth and really just be in a space where they can be themselves. And that's another thing I think which is really important to pay attention to is that you meet youth that kind of have the track, the background like myself, being institutionalized and in the foster care system. They're not going to speak the same language as anyone else, if you will, that does not have any familiarity with that world, because it is another world. You're programmed when you're in some of these institutions, and when you come home and you start another school, you it's not familiar to you. So that can, you know, help some of our young people feel like hopeless, like I can't do this. And I think we need more work in that world, in that arena, to really accept the fact that this is what we're doing to some of the youth. We're having them enter into spaces where if they're leaving another, they might not be familiar or comfortable with. And we have to really, truly be acceptable to that.
In a moment, I'll ask Marla for her thoughts on what needs to be done to give kids a better structure, more love, better situations. You heard Ashley Cross mention earlier this hour that, you know, it's a system that is overtaxed, overworked. And Marla just mentioned the Hub 585 for people just popping in again. Remind people, what is the Hub 585?
Yeah, we are a Rochester-based nonprofit organization with the mission to educate, enrich, and empower youth and families through programs and partnerships that give them hope and help them thrive. Our vision is really simple, is to see a city restored. And we think that restoration comes by protecting children and strengthening families. So we really focus a lot on strengthening families. You know, we really want to get into helping those birth families, because I think that we can have more Anquanettas out there if they had Angels of Mercy, right? And then you have the Marla Dinkles out there. That story's not, it's not as pretty, right? And so it's like, well, how do we intercept and work with these young people? So that's really what we're about, is helping our city's most vulnerable children and families.
Marla, what do you want to see happen? I mean, what realistically in your mind could happen so that there are fewer people who experience the lifelong hurt that you have experienced?
I would like to see what could happen. What I know can happen is that we're able to connect with this population, these youth, and help them know there are people that understand, and that they're not outcasted, and they're not, you know, different, or they're less than the less represented, these terms that are given. And I like for more work to be done where they can sit in a space and feel absolutely normal, you know, the traditional way when you're going out to eat or you're at a school, and just, you know, the normal things that families do. I'd like to see more of the opportunity for our youth to be involved in that way. I know for a fact, for me, those are the things that have a, like, not to say it holds me back, but, you know, I still deal with today. I'm not as social as a lot of people are. I'm out, I work and have children and things, but there are certain things, like what you mentioned earlier, is that some youth have mentioned they don't have trust. I still deal with these things to this day. I think supporting this population and our young youth with this background, it continues to help give me continued hope, and to know that, you know, I can seem misunderstood, but I can get around some youth who, when they meet me, you know, they might just feel like, hey, this lady really truly understands us. But it does the same thing. It's reciprocated. It's like, these youth really understand me. And I think together it just is a powerful love. And I really believe truly that's one of the biggest parts that our youth, a lot of our youth are missing out on, is that love, traditional family love.
Actually,
it seems so simple, but it's a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, for you, what are the possible levers that can be pulled here that will start to make change? I mean, it's going to take a long time. It's a lot of kids in the system, but what can happen?
Yeah. So from a very practical standpoint, I always tell people it's not like thinking or praying about if you should do something. It's thinking or praying about what you should do. I think we all have a role to play in strengthening our child welfare system. So what that could look like is signing up to be a mentor, right? Like signing up to say, you know what, I am going to be that permanent factor in a child's life. We're starting a mentorship program in June. We're still looking for mentors. And what happens is those mentors get to go with the child anywhere they go. So you blow your placement, guess what? You still have that same mentor that's going to show up. They're not paid. And that's another thing. Children in foster care, they need at least one unpaid adult in their life. If you think about it, a child in foster care, all the adults in their lives that are consistent are there they're consistent because they're paid, right? It's the CPS worker, the teacher, they're all professionals. So to have one unpaid person that can look that kid dead in their eye and say, I'm here because I want to be. I get nothing from being here except for you. You're my reward. You know, my relationship with you, that's what I get for showing up. That can start to really heal and really start to, I believe, move the system forward, because if the community could wrap around, it takes some of the burden off of child welfare workers, right? Child welfare workers could have 30 cases. And that, when I say cases, that's not 30 children. That's 30 cases. That could be one case, could be a sibling set of six, right? And they are responsible for these children and their lives. If we as a community can wrap around and say, we'll alleviate some of that by just signing up to be mentors, or we'll alleviate some of that by even helping a foster parent.
And on the subject of mentors, quick question from a listener here. Mm-hmm. Patrick says he works in landscaping. He says, gardening and landscaping is a business where you can make money helping other people who can't do it for themselves. I believe if somebody spent 4 hours a day with me, they would learn life lessons, they could get paid, skills they can take to any company or start their own business with. Is that the type of mentoring we're talking about?
That's the type of person I want to reach out to me, right? Because you can either be a mentor, and let's say that you have we have a young person that's a skill set of theirs. It's not a skill set of theirs, but let's say it's something they're interested in. Then absolutely.
How do they find you?
www.thehub585.org, or you can email me directly at across@thehub585.org.
So there you go. So Patrick and anybody else listening, thinking, you know what? Ashley's right. It's not if I should help, it's what I should do and what I can do as mentor.
But we also need business owners that will be patient with these young people. So maybe you're saying, I don't have time to be a mentor. But if you can employ one or two of them and not fire them when they're late the first time, right? Teach them, be patient with them, understand where they're coming from, understand that they're behind. They might be behind. Some of the life skills that they would have learned from a traditional family, they don't have those life skills. And so we see unemployment as a major barrier for these young people because employers don't know how to have patience. I mean, they don't sometimes even know these youth and their stories, understandably so. But, you know, people like Patrick, if you could employ some of these young people and be patient and teach them the skills that they need, that's a win as well.
We've covered so much ground, and I just want to say again, the website is thehub585.org.
Yep.
And you'll learn more about Ashley Cross, her work there, the organization, and what they plan to do. And I'm sure there's lots of ways for people who can help. It's got to be creative with an open heart. What an amazing hour it's been. And I want to thank our guests. So Marla Dinkle, I really very much appreciate how direct your story is, because it helps us understand the realities here. And I wish nothing but the best for you. Thank you for telling the story, Marla.
You.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, yeah, you're most welcome. I appreciate the opportunity to have the discussion. Thank you.
You got it. And Quinetta Campbell and Annette Campbell. And Quinetta, thank you for sharing your family story.
No problem. It was my pleasure.
Jordan Edwards, great meeting you. Thank you very much. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
And Jordan's amazing mom, Ashley Cross, the founder and executive director of the Hub 585. Thanks for what you're doing here.
Thank you, Evan.
From the whole team at Connections, and especially behind the glass today, Megan, Julie, and Rob saying thanks for listening. We're back with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.